Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us today on this special edition of Gold Radio Cafe. It's Wednesday, May 29th, 2013. My name is Bosco Kacharovich, and this program is brought to you by Central Metals, your gold and silver bullion dealer. Our website is centralmetalscorp.com, and our phone number is 800-649-6722. We are located here in Windsor, Ontario, Canada, and our email is mail@centralmetalscorp.com. We have the gold markets here as trading at $1,392.22, and silver. Let me just bring up the price here for you, folks. Is $22.50. This episode of Gold Radio Cafe, we are expecting to have Harley Schlanger from the Executive Intelligence Review join us. Possibly Harley is having some technical difficulties, but it looks like he's here now. But Harley is the Southwest Bureau Chief for the Executive Intelligence Review for more than 15 years. He has written numerous articles on economics involving the savings and loans crisis and issues surrounding Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And we're very pleased to have Harley join us today. If we can get him on the line here. I think we have a connection here. Let me just check. Harley, can you hear us?
Yes, I hear you fine.
Okay, good. We just went through your introduction, and welcome to the program. We're glad to have you back.
It's good to be back. It's been a while.
Yes, it has been a while.
A lot has happened.
Yes, many things are changing, and it's quite a dynamic situation we have here. Harley, I'd like to jump in right into what this program is scheduled for, the discussion of the Dodd-Frank bill. And I just want to give our listeners a quick opening remarks from the press release from the LaRouche PAC organization, which was issued on May 26. It says, whether your congressman and senator know it or not, Wall Street and the City of London's too-big-to-fail banks have been given the keys to your savings account and will steal every penny that you think you own the minute they get into trouble and need another bailout. This is not some wild futuristic nightmare. This has been the reality ever since Congress passed the Dodd-Frank Act, and in quotes, the Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act of 2010, and President Barack Obama has signed it into law. This is pure treason. This is quite a serious issue, Harley, and could you shed some light onto this situation, how we came here, and what the possibilities are for people's bank accounts?
Well, the immediate thing that caught people's attention was the bail-in that the EU, the European Union, and the IMF ordered for the small island country of Cyprus. This is back in late February, early March of this year. And people were somewhat astounded that the European Union could demand that the government of Cyprus seize savings accounts above 100,000 euros. And initially they were talking about 20%, 100%. No one was sure how much they were going to seize. But the argument that was thrown out was that, well, Cyprus owes money. They don't have it in the country. The banks have money in their banks, but it belongs to their depositors. But that money should be made available for what they call the bail-in, because the European Central Bank said they would not give money, a bailout to Cyprus, unless Cyprus came up with some money itself. Now, of course, this scandalized everyone. People heard about it, and the Cyprus parliament voted it down. The government collapsed, the new parliament came in, and by a 29-27 vote, they went along with this. And immediately, what happened is that 27.5% of all savings accounts above 100,000 euros were seized by the bank and then used to pay back debt to the European Central Bank. In return, you got the equivalent of the money seized in stock in what was already a bankrupt bank. Then, on top of that, I'm sorry, it was 37.5%. 37.5% of the deposits were taken. And then 22.5% were frozen. So 60% of all deposits over 100,000 euros. And what made this a big scam, and also they limited how much you could take out of the other 40%. And so Cyprus was immediately plunged into a depression. Unemployment went through the roof. The economy collapsed. Small businesses. And you know very well that there are many small and medium-sized businesses that have more than 100,000 euros on hand at any point because you have to make purchases, you have to do payroll, you have to pay various kinds of costs. Now, what made this frightening to some people was that Asmussen, one of the directors of the European Central Bank, called this the Cyprus template and said it should be applied to Italy, Spain, and other European nations. So we took that as a sign that, you know, forget just Europe. This is probably, there's something bigger going on here. And what we dug up initially was a report from the U.S. Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Now, that's the FDIC. That's what insures your deposits up to $250,000. They and the Bank of England did a study back at the end of last year where they concluded that a bail-in was a good idea for England and the United States. So we read this, we went back further and found two really striking things, and that's what is in our press release. First, that in early 2009, when Barack Obama went to his first G20 meeting, Group of 20 meeting, the leading industrial nations of the world, he signed an agreement which opened the door for bail-ins. Not just of U.S. deposits for U.S. banks, but U.S. deposits for branches of foreign banks operating in the United States. And then this was written into the Dodd-Frank bill under Title II on bank resolutions, which basically says that in order to avoid future bailouts, the idea of bail-in is now acceptable and, in fact, law for the U.S. banks. Now, let me just point out two caveats here that exist but really shouldn't be taken too seriously. First, they say that, well, this is only for deposits above the insured amount. Now, if anyone believes that, they're not paying attention because they now have the keys, as we say, the keys to your bank account. And secondly, this would mean that under the new law, the Dodd-Frank law, the nature of banking itself has changed. It's no longer when you put money in an account, whether it's a savings account or checking account or any kind of account, and the idea is that the bank owes you that money. Under this new interpretation, which is now the law of the land, the bank, it's actually the bank's money. It's like you're investing in the bank. And we have on our website a thorough review with the citations in the Dodd-Frank bill and some legal interpretations that have already been printed for the Cornell Law Review, for example, and others that show that this is in fact operative in the United States. And I might add as well, Harper in Canada has done the same thing with the bail-in policy. So that's why we say the title is Dodd-Frank Kills, How the U.S. Joined the International Bail-In Regime. And this is available at LaRouchePack.com for any of your listeners to go in and read it.
Yeah, we have a link on our website to the LaRouche website as well. So Harley, let me get this straight. Originally, it was back in 2008. The central bankers decided that they needed to bail out the financial institutions. So what they did was the central banks basically sold the government money, and in return they received bonds, treasury bills, and so on, which
mortgage-backed
affected the taxpayers.
Yeah.
Okay,
yes.
So it was a liability to the taxpayers. Now,
exactly.
So I imagine that they attempted to bail out the system, which obviously didn't work. Okay, because otherwise they wouldn't now come up with this bail-in process. So now, because
well,
the taxpayers
very quickly, the reason it didn't work, and this is very important, is mm-hmm. that instead of wiping the toxic assets off the books, letting them price down to their actual market value and selling them off at losses, instead
mm-hmm.
the bailout said they could keep not only those assets on their books at face value, but they could
mm-hmm.
keep trading them. And if anyone called them in, you could go to the Federal Reserve to borrow to back it up. So the bailout
yeah.
was not just the $700 billion of the TARP initial money.
Mm-hmm.
It was somewhere, Neil Barofsky estimates, $24 to $27 trillion. But more
mm-hmm.
importantly, they held on to the bad debt. There was no bankruptcy. There was no moral hazard, nothing. Now,
yeah, so,
what happened then? Oh, go ahead.
Well, I mean, to me, this is like Alice in Wonderland. I mean,
it's insane. It's completely crazy.
They're moving money around. There's no fundamental backing to it, and now they're coming up. It seems to me that this is just propaganda, papering over, because there's no real substance to any of these assets. There's derivatives floating around, whether they're bail-in or bail-out. So now what they're doing, from my perspective, it looks like they've seen, okay, taxpayers were upset because, oh, you know, we don't want to upset the taxpayers. Well, now, okay, well, we're not going to upset the taxpayers. It's not going to be your liability. We're just going to go into your savings account and just steal the money right away from you.
That's exactly
basically
what happened.
They're saying.
The argument of Dodd-Frank and also of the Vickers Commission in the United Kingdom, of the Liikanen Commission, which is the name of the European Union Commission that looked into this, they all said, look, at some point there's going to be social explosions over bailouts because we're creating trillions of dollars or euros of liabilities for the taxpayers, and in return we're cutting their basic government programs, including not just food stamps and Medicare and Social Security and things of that sort, but infrastructure, any kind of job program. Life is getting much harder for most people in the transatlantic region because of the austerity, which is not going to solve anything. But the problem they had is that even with, and we estimate somewhere close to $11 trillion has actually passed hands so far in the various quantitative easing programs. That is, as you said, the purchase of bonds, of CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, mortgage-backed securities, and so on. The Fed and the other central banks have created somewhere around $11 trillion of funny money liquidity to the banks. They figure there's another $7 trillion in deposits that they could get. But here's the problem. Add that up, that's $18 trillion of what is essentially, at least the deposits, is real money. How does that cover minimally $700 trillion to upwards of close to $1.4 quadrillion, which is the value, the nominal value of derivatives that are being held by these financial institutions? So even if they do steal all the deposits, they can't even begin to cover the hole they've created. And that's where you see the craziness of it.
So we can understand now that people need to understand, I think it's very important, that money in your bank is not safe. Okay, cash in your bank account is not the safest place for investment. So, Harley, let's take this a step further. Now, if they're instituting this kind of an idea, what are people to do? Well, if they realize that their money in the bank is not safe, they're going to think that, okay, well, I'm going to go buy stocks in the stock market. Could that be the reason why the stock market is going up in nominal value, that people are saying, well, if my money in the bank isn't safe, maybe I should invest in the stock market. Is there any insurance, or what covers the investments in the stock market?
Well, the stock market explosion going way up, the bubble, has not been the result of individual investors moving money out of banking accounts. There's some of that. That's a marginal factor.
Mm-hmm.
But usually if people are too afraid to put their money in banks, they're not going to put it in the stock market, because you have to be
right.
an idiot not to see that this is a bubble. Most mm-hmm. of the stock purchases are by institutions in large amounts that they're purchasing based on getting the 0% money from the Federal Reserve. So the
mm-hmm.
Fed is feeding a stock bubble. And they're saying, well, this really isn't a bubble, because consumer confidence is up, at least last month it was, and the
mm-hmm.
housing industry seems to be recovering. But then if you actually look at the housing industry, a real recovery for housing is when single families come back onto the market. And for that to occur, you have to have improvement in job opportunity. You have to
mm-hmm.
have families that are getting jobs that pay a living wage so they can get a mortgage. Right now, banks are not giving many mortgages to people who are getting the jobs created by Obama, because they're mostly part-time, temporary, and low wage. So you look more closely at the housing figures, and what you find is large new companies buying 1,000 homes at a time, and because the homes are low priced still now, and they can get 0% interest to buy them. And then they're not going to sell them until the prices go up. They're going to turn them into rental properties. And people who have lost their homes and can't get a mortgage are going to be forced to pay top dollar for a foreclosed house owned by some mega housing company. So this is why LaRouche is saying this is a bubble. The housing
right.
market and the stock market are nothing but a bubble. Now, I would add
yeah.
one other thing, which is a lot of people. Last time I was in your program, gold was topping out somewhere around 2,200 an ounce and still going up. And a lot of people thought, well, gold is the solution. And we saw them pull the plug on the gold market at a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
that's not really, if that were supply and demand, gold would be at 5,000 an ounce right now.
Right.
Because people don't want to have money. So the question of what do people do to survive in a situation like this, this is where your survival depends on political action. It depends in the United States on forcing the real solution to the banking crisis, which is the return to the Glass-Steagall Bill from 1933,
mm-hmm.
which
mm-hmm.
separates commercial and investment banks, would protect the commercial banks because you protect the depositors, you protect the local economy,
mm-hmm.
but would not protect or bail out any of the funny money, the speculative funny money, that makes up over 95% of the assets of the largest banks, the 12 largest banks. Now, Glass-Steagall has over 60 sponsors for H.R. 129 in the House of Representatives, and we
mm-hmm.
just got a companion bill in the Senate 2 weeks ago. Senator Harkin from Iowa, a longtime Democrat who's retiring and maybe decided to do something good before he leaves the Congress,
right.
he introduced the Senate version, which is, I think, S-985. So the reason this would work is that it would supersede Dodd-Frank. Now, the key thing to know about Dodd-Frank is that 80% of the regulations with Dodd-Frank are not contained in the original bill. It's 800 pages of basically language about what should be done, but it leaves the actual regulations to be written. Now, about 30% of those regulations have now been written, and they exclude any regulation of derivatives. And not surprisingly, the regulations are being written by experts from Citibank, from the International Swaps and Derivatives Dealer Association, Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan Chase, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So the bankers are writing the so-called regulatory reform to make sure that they can continue the swindle. And now they know they'll be backed by the right to take the deposits from their customers
mm-hmm.
if they need to.
Okay, now, Harley, if the let's assume that the Glass-Steagall Act gets reinstated, and the offshoot of that would be okay. It would. I would imagine that the result of that would be a number of investment banks on Wall Street going bust, and the risk that they're promoting here is that they need to keep the systemically important banks solvent so they can actively function. Now, if we take that function away from them, what would be, how would that affect the economy in the U.S.? Like, I imagine that if these big banks go under, which I imagine most of the banks are the ones that are really controlling the politicians and
right.
Creating these new laws and policies and so on. If Glass-Steagall is reinstated and remove the power from these big banks, how would that result in a better economy?
Well, in the short term, what the H.R. 129 has in it is a year transition, during which
mm-hmm.
time the banks have to choose whether they're going to be a commercial bank or an investment bank. In other words, no more so-called universal banking where you buy insurance, stocks, and bonds and have your checking account at the same place. That would
okay.
end. But the banks would have a year to decide what to do and then to start unwinding. Now,
mm-hmm.
that could be extended. For example, if you have a bank like J.P. Morgan Chase, which makes 90% of its profits from trading,
mm-hmm.
if they wanted to be a trading company, then they would have to get rid of their commercial banking. But
mm-hmm.
the problem they would have is that their trading desks know that they're sitting on top of the 90% of their assets, many of which are leveraged 30-1, which means they don't really have what they think they have. And
mm-hmm.
as they unwind it, it's going to have a big effect. I mean, the stock market bubble will pop, and people who are depending on the stock market for their retirement are going to be in the same position as those in 2008, 2009 who are counting on their home equity as their retirement. This is all
mm-hmm.
funny money. It's not there. And the sooner we clear it away and start investing in real physical production, the quicker we'll have an economic recovery. What's happening now is all the liquidity is being sucked into speculative activity. And
mm-hmm.
so we're seeing an accelerating contraction of real physical wealth production, you know, in terms of machine tools, in terms of equipment, in terms of food production even.
Mm-hmm.
That's all disappearing. Now, we've got to
right.
reverse that. And
mm-hmm.
that means people are going to take a loss. It means the 401k that's gone up again because of the stock market is going to go right back down. It means that a lot of the people who were, in addition to their 401k, were feeling lucky and getting involved with various kinds of money market accounts and investment accounts that are not guaranteed are going to lose money. But that money's really gone anyway. And the whole point to this is that if we don't get back to physical production, it doesn't matter how large your 401k is, there's no way to access it or buy anything.
Right.
That's what hyperinflation is.
Right. And I mean, this is quite a conundrum, a complex issue that we're involved, because I mean, if the Glass-Steagall Act is instilled and these big banks go bust, people's, like you said, their retirement funds are going to go down and they're going to lose. So the people don't want that, right?
Well,
so,
let me just say one thing on that's important is that under the current bankruptcy laws, if these banks go into bankruptcy, it's the senior bondholders who get the money first from selling off whatever they can sell off of their holdings. And
mm-hmm.
it's the depositors and the unsecured investors, namely the little guy, who's at the end of the line anyway. What we would do with Glass-Steagall is ensure that the money would not go to the senior bondholders and to the people who created the swindle. They would
mm-hmm.
be the ones at the end of the line, and anything – for example, if you have a $10 million mortgage-backed security that's really worth about $1 million, that would go to the smaller investors, and the $9 million loss would go to the people who ran the thing. So you try as much as possible to have some justice and equity. The system as it is now, under Dodd-Frank, puts financial stability number one, which means protect the banks, the banks' paper holdings, and number two, the senior bondholders and debt holders. And at the bottom of the pyramid is the small guy, and it's the small guy who they're going to steal from now to get a little more liquidity to keep them in business. So it is Alice in Wonderland through the looking glass. You're absolutely right about that.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, you know, obviously the I would imagine that people that are in retirement now and have some money in retirement probably would be against this Glass-Steagall bill. But I would imagine people in the younger generation who are getting out of school or just started their careers would probably want the Glass-Steagall bill because it promises a more stable future. So it looks like we have a battle between two different generations. I mean,
it's between two different moralities, though.
It's
two different moralities. Because, you know, it used to be that the older generations were willing to sacrifice for the benefit of the younger. And what happened with the baby boom generation is the idea that we're going to have it all. We can have whatever we need. Who cares about the future? It's for us now, the Pepsi generation, you know, now for us, me. Now, what we're going to have to see is that we're going to have to appeal to the real interest of retirees, that they're going to leave a better society for their children and grandchildren. We're not going to leave them in poverty. We're going to make sure that Social Security's there, that Medicare is there, and these are all things that are being attacked by Obama and the Republicans and the austerity policies. So we would protect those kinds of interests. And once the economy gets back on its feet, we won't have to worry about Social Security or Medicare being solvent. The reason they're heading toward insolvency is you have more and more people who are now living off the system and fewer people putting anything into it. That would be reversed because with Glass-Steagall, the next phase would be a credit policy and investment in rebuilding the infrastructure of this country, starting with a few great projects that will return profit in the form of productive gains as opposed to costing money for make-work jobs. We want real productive jobs, that, like the Roosevelt programs, the TVA, the WPA, the CCC. These all return some physical wealth to the economy, as opposed to Obama's stimulus plan, which basically hired government workers to figure out where the stimulus money was going.
Well, I mean, yeah, even the stimulus money didn't do anything. Like, I can't, you know, you sit back and look at all these numbers that they're throwing around, trillions and trillions of dollars, and the promise was that it's going to produce an economic recovery. And from what I'm seeing, talking to my clients and just what's going on around in not only in the U.S. and Canada, but in Europe as well, obviously we know what's happening in Europe, that there is no recovery, and the system is even getting worse. So you know,
it is worse than that. I just spent most of the last year in Europe, and you look in Greece, youth unemployment is 60% in Greece. It's almost 55% in Spain. Now, Americans can say, well, how can they do that? Well, youth unemployment of African Americans in major cities of the United States is 50%. You know, if it weren't for the underground economy of drugs and guns and things of that sort, you would have a social explosion that would make the riots of the 1960s look like the good old days. So the real point there is that the older generation can look and say, what is my legacy? You know, if the older generation is going to depend on their 401ks for their sense of identity, those are hollow hopes. Then they can look at their children and grandchildren and say, did I leave something for them of a future? And that's why Mr. LaRouche always says you can't separate morality from a constitutional process of physical production, because the reason we live is not to die with a flush bank account, but to know that we've added something that will be of benefit to future generations. And that's the shift in morality that we've had with, especially to some extent with Clinton, but especially with Bush and then Obama.
Yeah, things started changing. I mean, after, I guess, you know, the introduction of allowing these derivatives to function as a an asset after, I think it was in the late 90s when Brooksley Bourne warned about allowing these derivatives to be deregulated, or I don't remember exactly what her
speech was about.
Well,
there were two bills. One was the Graham-Leach-Bliley of 1999, which repealed the rest of Glass-Steagall.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2000, the Commodities Future Modernization Act, which again was Phil Graham at the center of that, which completely deregulated all futures markets, all derivative markets. And now it's close to 90% or 80% of derivatives are over the counter, which means nobody even knows what's in them. And
right.
this is the least transparent financial system that's ever been invented. And the only thing that you see is enormous dollar figures and profits for the banks by buying and selling these things. And some of it drips down through the 401ks and through some of the investment plans, but it can be wiped out in an instant, as we saw almost $10 billion wiped out in the London Whale backfire of Jamie Dimon for J.P. Morgan Chase, or the brilliant genius Larry Summers, who nearly bankrupted the Harvard Endowment when he deregulated that to allow them to buy derivatives.
Right.
So a lot
yeah,
of money can go up in smoke. Yeah.
Yeah. We have one of the notes here I wrote down on the article from your website there is regarding the what we discussed, the unsecured creditors. So basically now it's law. When you deposit money in the bank, you're considered an unsecured creditor, and you will become a stockholder. You'd mentioned in the article
whether you like it or not.
Regarding so you're instantly an investor and taking risk instead of secured money, your money in the bank.
That's right.
It's not your money, like you said. And you know, coincidentally, yesterday I got an article here. The headline reads: Spain's Bankia decimates savers as stock plummets. Police officer stabs banker who sold him the shares. Apparently, the stock value of Spain's Bankia dropped more than 80% after the bail-in process was finalized. So
the
Bankia
was the first bail-in. Bankia was one of the first bail-ins, and that was because the bank was bankrupt, and the government didn't have the money to bail it out because the government was having to borrow like crazy from the European Central Bank to protect its other banks. So in Bankia, that was the first bank that did a bail-in. And there were some near riots when people were told you're no longer depositors, you're now investors in the bank. And as you said, the stock is collapsing because what is the bank investing in? All it's doing is recycling whatever loans it gets to pay debt. So they're paying other banks, and their shareholders, that is their former depositors who are now investors, are losing everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what I would really recommend for your listeners is at larouchepac.com, which is LaRouchePac.com. The article we're discussing is called How the U.S. Joined the International Bail-In Regime.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll find along with that a number of other articles on this bail-in process. Also, if you click on the icon that says Glass-Steagall, you'll get the list of endorsers of the bill, that the congressmen who have signed, the numbers of people who have called for this, like Thomas Honig, who's the former Kansas City Federal Reserve president, now a vice chairman of the FDIC.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can begin to get a sense that there is motion now. And as people realize what you and I are discussing is reality, and that either you be prepared to take huge losses. And when I say huge losses, I don't just mean in money. What we're seeing is a decimation of farm production, a collapse of the infrastructure. We just had a couple bridges collapse in the last few days. At the same time, we're seeing horrific weather events, weather-related events, whether it's tornadoes or hurricanes, and governments without the money to prepare for these. We don't have the redundancy anymore to provide security. So we have to reverse this very quickly. It is, as LaRouche says, a matter of life and death. And anybody who argues, give Dodd-Frank more time, which is what a lot of congressmen are saying, they are traitors, because they're essentially either ignorant of the fact that Dodd-Frank is not there to allow for a recovery, but to protect the speculators and swindlers. Either they're ignorant of that, or they're dependent on those swindlers for their campaign financing. And that's
what I think it's the latter of the two. Obviously, it seems to me that, you know, that there are people benefiting from this in high finance and so on, and they don't want to relinquish their power. But, I mean, as clearly, I've watched many of LaRouche's broadcasts, and clearly the solution is you have to separate these two banks. It functioned much better, I believe, under the Glass-Steagall Act. But it looks like that we've gotten to a point, Harley, where, you know, it's kind of people, by getting Glass-Steagall back in, you know, there's a lot of people that are going to feel the pain initially. It's like taking a Band-Aid off. You have to do it quick or you do it slowly. I think in putting Glass-Steagall back in is going to be the quick fix. People are going to feel some pain, but I think the longer term benefit is going to be much better for the next generation. So, like, you know, we said, it's a moral issue, and it's quite.
People are going to feel pain. People are going to feel pain very
either way, yeah.
Anyway, because the question is, you know, with the austerity, the argument always is, well, if you do the austerity the right way, you get things in balance, and then you can start growing again. And now it's been shown that the people who presented that argument, Rogoff and some other character, that doctored the data they used. It's clear that if all you do is cut spending, you're depressing the situation further. That's what's happened to Greece. That's what's happened to Italy and Spain. You know, a former prime minister, a candidate for prime minister in Portugal, said that what's being done to the southern European countries is essentially a march into concentration camps, because people are working for less and less money, and they're starving to death. Suicide rates are up. Hospitals are closing. And that's what we're seeing in this country. And in this country, you have idiotic Republicans who say that we've got to cut the budget. And then you find the president of the United States is in bed with them, a nominal Democrat.
Right.
And we're seeing a bit of a revolt from some of the Democrats and some of the more sane Republicans, especially from farm states, who see the devastation when you shut down local banks and community banks because they can't get credit. So they don't have credit to give to their local economy, whereas Wall Street banks, the too big to fail banks, or the systemically important financial institutions, I like that one because it's sci-fi.
They're
just flush with cash. So this is not just upside down, but it's a deliberate attack on the living standards of the majority of the population for the benefit of institutions that exist outside of the control of any government.
And this is one of the comments that I make to a lot of my clients. The what's happening now, like, we don't really advocate gold and silver here as an investment that you're really going to profit on, because gold essentially is a barometer of the economic condition around the world. And I mean, of course, over the past 10, 12 years, gold has been the best performing asset, but it's not really an asset, it's just a store of value. And, you know, I just wanted to note, you know, people that have gold, physical gold in their possession, don't have to worry about any bail-in process, because the banks can't just take it away from you if it's in your possession. But the fact remains, you know, the problem is the living standard. When we have a high gold price, nobody in their right mind wants gold to go to $5,000, because that will mean complete an economic chaos. And, you know, everybody would rather have a stable and sound economy than a high gold price. And
well, that's why
so,
I'm saying that the idea of individual survival is what some people think of as gold. Well, I'm going to have my guns, my beef jerky, and my gold, and I'm going to make it through.
Right.
The problem is that if you don't have, and this is where the question of what is the function of government comes in.
Because
you have a lot of these so-called conservatives who want to see the government downsized and destroyed. And the fact is that while human rights are innate in man, as the Declaration of Independence says, that we're endowed by our Creator with inalienable rights, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness.
Right.
But you need institutions of government to defend those rights from private interests, which benefit from eliminating those rights. And what we're seeing now is the worst of all possible worlds, where in the name of free enterprise and free markets, a deregulation and a trampling of institutions of government has occurred so that these financial institutions actually run the government. That's what Dodd-Frank represents. There was an effort made to get Glass-Steagall put into the Dodd-Frank bill, interestingly by a liberal Democratic senator from Washington State, Cantwell, and John McCain. So it was a bipartisan bill. And Dodd and Frank were told by Geithner and Obama to kill that, to not allow Glass-Steagall in. And so what you have is an alliance of the City of London and Wall Street with the President of the United States, Geithner, Bernanke, and some key Republicans who are saying, well, we don't want Glass-Steagall because it's regulation. The U.S. Constitution gives government the right to regulate interstate commerce. That's in the Constitution. How can you say you support the Founding Fathers when you selectively choose which parts of the Constitution you
to?
Regulation, there's a difference between complete and sane regulation of a nanny state versus regulation to create a level playing field so the private interests don't control money, which is what they do with the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England and the European Central Bank. It's the bankers who control monetary policy, as opposed to what the American system under Washington and Hamilton did, which was to establish a Bank of the United States that would issue credit based on demands from Congress. And, you know, we look at our Congress now and say, well, is that such a good idea? Well, let's change the damn Congress. You know, if these guys aren't going to be sensible, let's vote them out. But make it a principle as opposed to just, you know, an emotional, I don't like this, I don't like that. We need to have principles brought back. And that's what LaRouche PAC is trying to do with Glass-Steagall, with the credit policy, with the idea of funding of those projects which require government. And it's not that government sets up the construction companies to build them. You hire private firms to do it.
Right.
And the money goes from the government into private banks who are the ones who decide which companies are worthy of getting loans. So it is a free enterprise system. It's just that you don't allow credit to be determined by who's going to make the maximum profit at the expense of the general welfare.
Right. And we can see, I mean, you know, like you said earlier, the standard of living is being attacked in the West, and obviously there's global interests that really don't care, and that standard of living, in my opinion, is going over to China and India. Their manufacturing base is growing where ours is declining. So ultimately, I mean, it makes sense to me, the solution that LaRouche has come up with. When you look at it, I haven't seen any other better solution that would make common sense. I mean, you have to bring some kind of manufacturing and production back into our country. Everything's now gone to China, and the result of that is our lower standard of living, you know, which includes higher costs of food and energy and so on. So,
because we're now dependent on foreign countries for our food supply. You know, this is the first time that we've been dependent on other countries to feed Americans. You know, about 80% of the dried milk powder comes from New Zealand, from Brazil, from other countries. You know, we're we're taking beans and corn off the plates of starving Mexicans. And meanwhile, we're taking our own corn crop, what there is of it, and turning it into inefficient fuel. So we've gone completely crazy. And LaRouche traces this back to the late 60s with the assassination of John and Robert Kennedy, because with the Nixon administration, you had the takeover of the real monetarists, the George Shultz, the Paul Volckers, Arthur Burns. These are people who said an economy is about money and the flow of money, as opposed to the older style, you know, the old school, an economy is about physical production.
Right.
And if you shift from a physical production standard to a purely profit-driven, cheaper is better, the cheap labor, cheap raw materials, that's the old British Empire. And in effect, we're now seeing a modernized British Empire centered in the city of London, which uses their control of financial institutions to dominate the planet. And as you say, China and India, China in particular, they're doing things a little differently. They're doing some of what we did in the 60s, namely a space program, infrastructure, trying to lift their population out of poverty, and they still have a long way to go. Russia, likewise, the reason there's so much anti-Russian sentiment from people like John McCain and some of the others in the targeting of Syria is that the Russians are saying, we're not going to use the money we're getting from our oil and gas today to put it into the euro markets. We're going to instead build new resource centers in Siberia. We're going to build up high-speed rail. We're going to improve the potential for future productivity. And
right.
That's a big difference.
Fixing their own backyard.
Yeah.
Instead of what we're doing is we're getting involved in other people's backyards and letting ours deteriorate. I mean, I think in a general sense, we got to, I think, like you said, I mean, bring back the productive labor of America, what's, you know, made in America. You don't see many things made in America anymore. And I think LaRouche is absolutely right. There's, that's the best direction to go. And whether that's going to be the best solution, I don't know, maybe a derivative of that solution or some minor changes, but
we're fighting for the whole enchilada. I mean, we're fighting for this idea that you've got to have a fundamental transformation. In fact, what we're really interested in is the second American Revolution, a break with this imperial financial system and a return to an American system, what was called in the 19th century the American system of economics. And Glass-Steagall is really the door that opens that potential. And if any of your listeners would like to get in touch with us to become part of this, because we've got mobilizations going on in every state of the country, we have 20 state legislatures in the United States that have introduced memorial resolutions for Glass-Steagall, and it's already passed in four of them, in Alabama, Maine, Indiana, and South Dakota. So if any of your listeners want to get in touch with me or with LaRouche Pack, there's a toll-free number they can call, which is 800-929-7566. And if you call that number... Oh, go ahead.
No, okay, there you have it, folks. We just got a couple minutes left here, Harley. So if you're interested in getting involved in the LaRouche Pack organization, you can visit their website there. Call the number that Harley just gave you. Any closing comments, Harley, of what people can do to, you know, to try and protect themselves or get involved, and maybe there's an email or something that they could contact somebody and get some more detailed information, or even subscribe to the Executive Intelligence Review.
Well, there are two things. You can call the 800-929-7566, or I'll give you, if someone wants to be in touch with me, I'll give you my personal email. I've been doing this recently and getting a lot of responses, and you know, if people really want to do something, I'm happy to talk to them, because I believe that it's an active, educated citizenry which is the key to this, not some leader on a white horse or some great congressman, but we've got to force the Congress to accept the will of the American people. So if someone wants to get in touch with me personally, My personal email is harleysch, it's H-A-R-L-E-Y-S-C-H, @gmail.com. And I will respond. It may take me a few days, but I will get back to you. But what we need is people who, even while they're being responsible and looking after themselves and their families, they have to realize that there's no durable survival unless our republic survives. And that's
right.
Why we've got to get back to these principles.
Exactly. Great. Harley, thank you for joining us today on this special broadcast, Gold Radio Cafe. We'd be more than happy to have you back on our program in the future. And with that, I hope you have a good week and look forward to seeing you again.
Okay, good talking with you today.
Thanks. Goodbye.